Evening, everybody. Welcome back to Transforming Problems into Happiness. I think all of you know my name. My name's Eddie, and I'm one of the tutors here. So let's begin by, first of all, adjusting your posture so that you feel quite comfortable in your seat. In essence, this means that your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. And while you're breathing normally and naturally, I'd like you to pay attention to what happens when you breathe. In other words, notice the movements that take place either at the abdomen or upper chest each time you inhale and exhale. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, imagine that the spiritual families of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are drawn in from the 10 directions of space and appear just slightly above your head in front of you. And that surrounding you is every sentient being. And they're all sitting on the floor or on the ground. And each of them is related to you in some way. So perhaps they've been a parent to you in a past life, an uncle or aunt, a brother or sister or child. And that while you were in that relationship, your happiness always depended upon their kindness. Yet, while they too wished to be happy and to equally avoid suffering, every one of them has never been genuinely happy. Now that the auspicious cause and conditions to awaken are present, decide to quickly attain for them the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, turn their mind to the truth. Help them practice the truth as a path. Help them remove obstacles from the path. And then purify their confusion into wisdom, revealing their natural birthright, the state of unchanging goodness. And to accomplish these goals, we're going to take refuge in the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and their family lineages in front of us. We're also going to generate the mind of enlightenment. So perhaps putting your hands together in the prayer mudra, recite along with me. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now that I'm stabilizing this wish and strengthening it, we can recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, to achieve enlightenment, we need to accumulate the causes and conditions that will bring about that state, and also liberate the mind from everything that hinders freedom. So the practices of merit and purification, these are all summed up in the seven limb prayer, so we'll recite that together. Reverently I prostrate my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now, some of the greatest hindrances towards enlightenment come from our side. So we have a great deal of clinging to the body and mind and ourselves and all the good things we do. Our body, our mind, a sense of self, and all the good appear to truly exist, and we grasp them, we cling to the appearance of true existence. And in fact, there's no true existence there. So here, specifically, you're going to let go of the clinging towards these objects. And in the absence of that clinging, imagine a wonderful pure land appears, whereby all beings can take the teachings from the enlightened beings, and you're going to offer this wonderful land to the field of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of you. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. So imagine now that the offering has been accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they smile at you with delight. Then the refuge field in front of you begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. It becomes very small, moves through space, and it abides above the crown of your head, facing the same way you are. Then he descends through space, entering the crown of your head, and down, down, down to the level of the heart at your chest. Then the light begins to expand, filling your body. The light is further filling your mind. It goes out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. All living beings who abide within space are touched by that light and transformed into fully awakened beings. And from the heart center of each of them, light rays again move out, filling all the directions of space. Now the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space. Once again, I'm pulling all the blessings back into your heart. And you acknowledge there's no difference in the very deepest level between yourself and any enlightened being. That you have the potential to fully awaken, and that potential is inherent to the mind. It's just the nature of mind that it can become fully awakened. And you possess that awakened nature. And you're going to awaken it to bring about the welfare of yourself and every other living being. And that's why you are primarily engaged in this class tonight. Now breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale forcefully through your mouth. And you just allow your eyes to flutter open. And find yourself in your seat in front of your screen. So now we're going to start the actual class. So here you can see we're reviewing what we've looked at over the past 8 weeks. And these are some of the things we looked at, and we're going to look at tonight. So tonight, we're just looking at these three assessment questions. So they ask questions about, you know, what's self-cherishing, what is cherishing others, what are the benefits of cherishing others, what's the attitude for each of those verses. And then I've put it like, how can we apply what we know to life itself? So let's begin by looking at the benefits first of all, and then we'll look at to see what, you know, self-cherishing and cherishing others actually are. Then we'll look at the eight attitudes, and finally the application. So there's a text called 7 Points for Mind Training, and in the preliminary to it, it says that these teachings are like a diamond. They're like the sun, and they are like a medicinal tree. So we have a simile. So thought transformation teachings are like a diamond. How? Why? And it said that, you know, diamonds are very, very hard, very precious, very difficult to break. And even if you were to break a diamond, it would still be very, very valuable. It doesn't lose anything actually by, you know, shards of diamond are still diamond. They're always hard, they're always bright, they're always valuable. So it's just saying that you take anything away from these thought transformation teachings and it'll be like that. Even if you can't remember all the verses, if you can remember a line and put that line into practice, it takes away, you know, suffering. It's sort of inner wealth. It's also said to be like the sun. So here the sun brightens everything that is dark and brings some warmth into the world. So here we can say, yeah, these thought train teachings remove the stuck feelings that we get sometimes when we don't know what to do. Illuminates our own wisdom and compassion for ourselves and for others. And it's really about the warmth is related to like the warm heart. If you can develop thought transformation teachings, you won't have any enemies. You'll feel warm-hearted to everyone. And once again, so even just like a ray of light will take away the darkness in that area, whereas the full sunlight removes all darkness altogether. Same again, you can take one line away from this and it can illuminate your whole life and make it valuable and meaningful. The third of the similes is a medicinal tree, and here it says that, you know, the medicinal tree, the roots, the trunk, the bark, the leaves, the berries, all of it is medicinal. You never get anything sort of poisonous from that tree. The whole lot's good. And it's the same sort of thing here, once again, with the teachings. If you had the complete tree and understood it completely, it would be great benefit for you. Because not only is this tree medicinal, the fact that it provides shade from the heat of the day. And so, any of these teachings, whether they be like a leaf or the bark or any part of it, protects you in terms of medicine and in terms from the heat of the day. So, in other words, you know, every part of the instructions on training the mind can cure all the mental diseases of the 84,000 afflictions, but any just a part of them will cure many problems that you meet with in daily life. In that same text, 7-point mind training, they talk about also that one of the great benefits of these mind training teachings is that you can transform the what they call the five degenerations. And these degenerations are the five you see on screen: the degeneration of time, living beings, the view, the delusions, and the lifespan. So if we look at it in terms of like our life today, you know, so we are within the field of time. There are living beings all around us. Everyone has views. Everyone has delusions. And everyone has a lifespan which can be long or short at any time. The delusions can appear whenever the conditions are right. People have all sorts of views, meaning ideas about how things are, and there are many different types of living beings.
Eddie, this is also very pertinent, especially today, literally, because it's, the American election, and it may seem like the world is burning as well, all the climate change and all of those things. So it's quite a
Yeah, pertinent, isn't it? You know? So in other words, this will say that when the times are difficult, living beings are difficult, the views are difficult, the delusions are plentiful, lifespans are so uncertain, then thought transformation is fantastic because it will transform these five. So I think that's pretty encouraging, isn't it? You know, we are living in times of great change, and it also seems that most of what's going on is out of our hands.
And so we have a teaching that is actually like tailor-made for times like these.
Yeah, that's right. And the living beings themselves, there's not much peace and agreement between many of them, and so danger to life increases. And you know, all this is coming out of these living beings who have wrong views, wrong ideas about how things exist. And those views are coming out of their delusions. And these delusions, supported by these wrong views, are shortening our lifespans, putting our lives at risk. And that is the case, isn't it? Even though that is the case, having access to thought transformation teachings and being able to put them into practice will transform these five degenerations. Now, we're going to next move on to the worst view of all. This is the source of all these delusions, and this view is the view of called self-grasping ignorance. It's also called the view of the transitory collection. What it really means is that the so we're grasping, or the mind. This delusion of course, self-grasping ignorance, it supports a view that things exist in the way they appear to. Things ultimately exist without any dependence upon our conceptual designations, meaning without any dependence upon our mind and language. So they all appear to be real in and of themselves. And that's the view that most people have. the view of an objective reality. Depends upon the view of an objective and independent reality, their delusions arise. And then all the problems arise. So let's have a look now first at this thing called self-grasping ignorance. So you can ask, what is it? That's the first question we should ask. It's the belief in a nature or state that objects could have, in which they rely on nothing else. So, you know, you hear statements like, let the market decide. Yeah.
As if the market is a coherent thing.
Yeah, that's right. So this is the root of all the problems. Now, in this, so we're going to look at three things, actually. Self-grasping ignorance. Then we're going to look at self-centeredness, which we also know as cherishing ourselves. And the last one is cherishing others. So we have the stuff.
Well, while we're here too, there is a question about the stains on our mind. So is that relevant here or a bit further on?
Later on, I think.
Okay.
After we go through these first three, we can talk about the stains.
Yep. Okie dokie.
So self-grasping ignorance and self-centeredness or self-cherishing are not the same. And self-cherishing and cherishing others are actually opposite one another. Now, self-grasping ignorance and self-centeredness, although not being the same, both hinder progress on the bodhisattva path, and both are obstacles to Buddhahood. So self-grasping ignorance apprehends the self to be inherently existent. It apprehends all things to be inherently existent. Whereas self-centeredness holds our own happiness as more important than that of others. So that's simply said. Now, we have self-cherishing, so what's that? It's called an inferior obscuration and is a hindrance for bodhisattvas to abandon. So we have different types of obscurations. Probably you're most familiar with the afflictive obscurations, and then there are cognitive obscurations. And these obscurations are removed in different ways. So the self-cherishing. So I described it just a minute ago, didn't I, as a mental attitude or a type of mind which holds our own happiness to be more important than that of others. Now, self-cherishing and self-cherishing, that mind, can be focused on the self-grasping mind. So we have this strong view, we grasp at ourselves as being inherently existent, and then this view comes right along with it. And it says, yeah, and you know that, but you are more important than everyone else. Your happiness is most important. So first we're misapprehending how the I exists. So, you know, we don't see it as being just a label or a name. We see it being something more than that. So there's the self-grasping. If you see it as being more than a name, you're grasping at the self. Then right along with that comes this thing of, you're really important. I need to look after you. At the expense of others if need be. That's the self-cherishing mind. Now, self-cherishing doesn't cause self-grasping, and self-grasping doesn't cause self-cherishing. There's not a causal relationship there.
Really? That's Because I just would have thought naturally then self-grasping would cause self-cherishing.
No, it's not. No. That's what we naturally think. I mean, that's what we would normally think. I think it's a natural sort of conclusion, but it's just not true. And to find out more about that, I suggest a book called In Praise of Great Compassion, the book by the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. And there are parts in there that make it quite clear. Actually, I could just read that little section out for you if you like. Something else too, I should say. Self-centeredness and self-grasping do not have a causal relationship. One does not cause the other. They are also not the same nature. If one exists in a person's mind stream, the other is not necessarily present. So the arahats have abandoned self-grasping, but have subtle self-centeredness. Bodhisattvas below the eighth ground, who freshly enter the Mahayana path, that is, they are not arahats who later enter the Bodhisattva's path, have self-grasping, but do not have coarse self-centeredness. Coarse self-centeredness is abandoned upon generating spontaneous bodhicitta and entering the bodhisattva path, whereas subtle self-centeredness and its latencies are overcome upon attaining the eighth bodhisattva ground, although some sharp faculty bodhisattvas eliminate them before that. Subtle self-centeredness does not manifest once sharp faculty bodhisattvas reach the path of preparation and when middle faculty bodhisattvas enter the path of seeing. So here it's like that thing we talked about, Han, about how we also need to know about grounds and paths.
Yes.
Yeah. Because like I said, it's interesting too, when we hear the word self-cherishing, I'm sure most of us are only thinking of it in terms of its gross aspect.
Yeah, the coarse aspect.
Obvious, the coarse aspect.
And even then, just on an even more coarse aspect of when we hear that, then we think selfishness, which
that's right.
Most coarse, but not the common one we mean.
Yeah. It's an aspect of selfishness, that's for sure. There's definitely selfishness going on when we're self-cherishing. But you know, so here you can see where it's the subtle self-cherishing that the arahats are accused of having by the bodhisattvas.
So is that a kind of self-cherishing that does not harm others?
Yes, right. It doesn't harm others, but it's just concerned with their liberation.
So Alison's asking, is self-cherishing then putting ourselves first, and self-grasping is how we perceive what happens around us?
Yeah, I guess you could say that, Alison. It's like, you know, we are engaged with the world and everything looks as if it were true, truly existent. And thinking that it's true and it is a me and a world, self-cherishing goes, you're really important. I need, you know, You're like number one. You're more important than anyone else. And within that self-cherishing, that's a gross form of self-cherishing, is the ability to harm someone else to support your self-cherishing. So that's the most common type of self-cherishing there is, isn't it?
Yeah.
But like I said, but there has been one that is not that, because it's not tied up with the wish to harm. There's no malice involved. It's just I wish to attain enlightenment. Sorry, I wish to become free. I'm seeking freedom for myself.
When we get to this kind of level, then it really becomes important that if we are on the path, that we start off being like on the Bodhisattva path. Otherwise, we could very easily just get sidetracked onto just seeking our own liberation.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And even if one began, you know, sometimes when people begin on the Bodhisattva path and then they see how difficult it is, once again, they could give it up and go, I'm not going to hurt anybody, but I can't enlighten everybody. But I think I could myself. So I go for the, you know, a smaller enlightenment. So self-cherishing is a hindrance only for the bodhisattvas to abandon, not because their goal is enlightenment. And this cherishing of oneself will prevent the realization of that goal. So let's have a look now at cherishing others. What's that? So it's an understanding and affectionate response to the needs of others. So, although, you know, that's the wonderful thing about these texts, I mean, how they're unpacked. So the thing to unpack here is needs of others. What are the needs of others? So the needs of others are to have an absence of suffering and its causes, and to actually be, authentically happy. That's the deepest need of living beings, to be authentically happy and to no longer have suffering or its causes. So understanding that, and then the affectionate responses, then I cannot harm you. But what I need to do is help you as much as possible to have an authentic and legitimate form of happiness. So the feeling of cherishing is a sense that all living beings are important and that their happiness matters. So I'll just read you a little now from In Praise of Great Compassion. And this is really talking about how this mind that cherishes others is developed. This is what they call like the cherishing love. That's affectionate response, cherishing love. It is one of three forms of love. So first you have affectionate love, then there's cherishing love, and then there's the wishing love. And they're built up on one another. You need to build them up yourself. So you begin with affection for others, then you cherish them, really want to look after them, and you have a wish for them, which is, of course, to become enlightened. So, His Holiness says, to cultivate affection and a sense of endearment towards others, we can contemplate that they've all been our parents in previous lives and will be our parents in the future as well. The use of the mother-child analogy in cultivating love and bodhicitta is found in both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. While imperfect, this analogy is the best one found in our world, because this connection between parent and child is precious. It is the closest example we have to illustrate unconditional love and gratitude. The Pali tradition recommends seeing sentient beings as our children and cultivating unconditional love for them, wanting to protect them from harm and misery as a parent does his or her child. The Sanskrit tradition encourages contemplating sentient beings as our mother and feeling gratitude and the wish to repay that kindness through attaining Buddhahood.
That's a really nice distinction between those two, because you can see the benefits of both of those approaches.
Yeah, that's right. So that's later on when they talk, you know, when you have a look at the six causes in one result practice. So sometimes it said, you know, people say, well, I find it easier to meditate on love before compassion. And others say, I find it easier to meditate on compassion before love. So His Holiness has said, there's no certain causal nexus here. You can do it either way. You know, which is just what we read, sort of, you know, you can look at them as a child or you can look at them as a parent. Now, from the same book, Venerable Thupten Chodron said this. She says, I find contemplating others' kindness very helpful to do before meditating on the four immeasurables. Doing this changes how I feel about others and myself and opens my heart, because I realize the fact that I'm often blind to, that I have been, am, and will continue to be the recipient of incredible kindness from others. Dear ones, neutral people, hostile people, friends, strangers, and enemies, all have been kind to me, not only because they have been my parents in previous lives, but because I received the benefits of the labors and various activities they do in this life as well. With this awareness, turning my mind to being concerned about their well-being and wishing them to have happiness and be free from suffering comes much easier, almost automatically. So like I said before, first comes the affection. So it was wonderful. So I read this thing about this, the way you sort of develop it. It said, you know, first of all, like a mother has a child, and no matter what that child looks like, the fact that it's hers, she has affection for it. And then she really cherishes it. And then has these great wishes for it. So this is how it's sort of done in the world. And actually, in terms of the development, it's very similar. The only thing is when the affection comes in, it's not an affection that is sort of selfishly based.
So it's not biased of,
no, that's
of
right.
Favoritism. So it's as no. strong, but it's...
It's sort of based on reason, eh?
Yep.
Because it doesn't have that emotional content of, like, my child.
Yeah, so, I mean, many of the documentaries, you know, the hospitals and the new parents that I've seen, and over and over and over again, the father will be holding the new baby and say, in that moment, my whole life changed. I knew I loved this baby yeah. unconditionally, and I would do anything for them. I would kill for them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So one part of it's great, like that sort of natural affection.
And the cherishing, willing to give up everything yeah. of your own just with great, you know, joy and wanting to.
Yep, yep. And because you have their wishes at heart, eh? You have their best, you know, whatever you're wishing for. You know, like many parents do so much for their children with a wish that the child won't have to experience what the parent did. Yeah, so with this wishing love, we wish that, you know, that these, our children or our parents will not have to go through samsara again. In fact, I'm going to stop that. You know, I'm going to get enlightened and show them how to put an end to that. So, yeah, there's this wish, isn't it, that they become enlightened, but through our effort, we're going to help them. So now we're going to have a look at the verses themselves. And, of course, the first verse deals with this cherishing love, cherishing other sentient beings. It says, with the thought of attaining awakening for the welfare of all beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I will constantly practice holding them dear. So before we constantly practice holding others dear, and finding them precious, we sort of have to know something about those sentient beings. We also have to know that, what are the, we can see here, what are the benefits of holding them dear? Well, they are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So before we actually, what we need to do is to have a look at the benefits of cherishing others and, the reasons for doing so. So, one of the reasons is they've been so kind to us. That's what, we just said in the last slide with the Venerable Children and the Pali and the Sanskrit. They've definitely been, they've been incredibly kind to us when they were our parents and when they weren't. They're really kind. But what's the benefit of recollecting that? So we need to find out what those benefits are. And here are some of them. Your fear of others will diminish. Your anger will finally vanish. You'll have the supreme health, mental health. You become a refuge for others, and it helps you to become enlightened. Now, these are just a few of them that I just put down. There are many, many others. In fact, one of the books called The Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Arya Shantideva, the first chapter talks about the benefits of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is developed with this on the basis of actually cherishing others. Without cherishing others, we won't have a mind of enlightenment.
So, Eddie, it's great looking at this picture because, it says mental health, and there's so much now store put on mental health. And to get the most perfect mental health, this is how to do it. Like, this is the answer to problems, all of those things of fear and anxiety vanishes, all the anger problems vanish, we have the health,
So if we use the example of COVID at the moment, and we make it not so much about mental health, but physical health. So one of the simplest ways of doing it is that you put a mouth guard up, you put a mask over your face, so your breath can't go out and infect somebody. Right? So you protect others like that. Here it's very similar. You protect others from your own selfishness. Right? And you do that through knowing the great benefits of doing so, just like the great benefits of putting a mask over your face to stop the spread of COVID. It's not really about you, is it? It's more about the other. I've got to protect others from passing this transmission on. It gets passed on from person to person. The way I'll prevent that, stop it, is by wearing a mask. So the mind of enlightenment is a similar type thing. We've got to protect others from our anger and our selfishness, our states of fear, all these sort of things. How am I going to do that? Well, I'll put on the mask of the Bodhisattva. It is with cherishing others that I can do this. And I will end up in supreme health, supreme mental health. So not only have they been kind to us, but they are extremely precious, because without them, you can't gather the inner wealth of spiritual realization. You cannot be supremely healthy without relying upon the cherishing of others. So it can bring you, what they say, ultimate happiness or full enlightenment. So in summary, we're to see others as precious, and at the same time, subdue your egocentricity. It will be subdued if you can first cherish others. Now, with that verse, remember, I think the verse line said, with the thought of attaining awakening for the welfare of all beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. I remember one time Khyentse Rinpoche said, in our lives, what's the wish-fulfilling jewel? And he said, it's money. And so I liked that. I never forgot. It was like money and wealth. So we're saying, sentient beings are more important than money and wealth. They're more important than the economy. So hold them more dear than wealth, money, the economy. So subdue this, you know, me. Now, of course, to do this, we're going to have to be quite patient with others, aren't we? So it is related to the perfection of patience, but it's also related to the idea of equalizing self with others. Now, we've got to see here that we are at a very deep psychological level, even just the deep level of reality. We are no different than others. We have a wish to be happy. We have a wish to be free from suffering. If we are to actualize that wish, we need to cherish others more than ourselves. The fact is, if you are without the inner wealth of cherishing love, you will remain trapped within cyclic existence forever. And that's why you should always cherish others. Your own happiness will come about as a byproduct of genuinely caring for others. It's like, you know, saying that, you know, having an economy that works is a byproduct of looking after the people in society. Because if you go the other way, you won't have an economy or a society. So you go like the person. The person's happiness matters to us. And it matters to us in such a great way that we will actually cherish them. Now, in terms of the second verse, Geshe Langri Tangpa said, whenever I interact with others, I will view myself as inferior to all, and I will train myself to hold others superior from the depths of my heart. So what's actually going on here? We're trying to subdue pride or arrogance and tame the mind so that we can avoid the afflictions that pride will or arrogance will produce. So I suggest seeing yourself as lowly and cultivating respect for others. Now, this can be easily done if you can imagine strongly or train yourself to think that every person I come into contact with is a teacher to me. I'm a student. I'm a learner. Each person has something to teach me. They are superior. Ways of helping you do this is to think that all faults that arise need to be recognized by yourself in the mirror of the Dharma. So in other words, you know, we often think we don't see others as teachers. We see ourselves as being more of the teacher to them. We're the better, we're the smarter, we are superior to others. And any faults that I experience in my life are not mine. It's because the other people are doing things. So when we get upset, other people are making us upset. Well, that's completely mistaken. So we need to see that the fault is coming from our side. Now, we can also take another view that says, you know, living beings have no fault. So we are living beings, and the people that are external to us, other people, are also living beings, aren't they? Now, living beings, myself and others, have no faults. What does that mean? So the faults are from the side of the behavior, from the mind. I should not be getting upset at people. If there's any upset at all, I should be looking at is my own mind that's producing the upset. No? And these people are under the control of wild and crazy minds. It's the mind that is, it's this mind of self-cherishing, intertwined with self-grasping, that is hurting that other person, so that other person, you know, reacts against me.
See, this is so amazing, Eddie, as you're saying all of these now, like summarizing it, I'm just thinking so many of the really successful self-help books have said exactly this, like everybody that you meet, there's something that they are better at than you. You can learn something from them. So, you know, you profit enormously by recognizing that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So then the other third thing, as I said, you know, recognize your own faults in the mirror of the Dharma. Understand where you're at fault. Living beings have no faults. So view all living beings as supreme. That's the third way we can look at it. So supreme in what? Well, we should see them as, you know, it's funny, isn't it? We pay a lot of respect to our ordained teachers. We pay a lot of respect to images of the Dharma. Yet without sentient beings, we can't get enlightened. So why don't we pay as much respect to them? So we definitely need teachers. We need teachings. But many of the good qualities are actually dependent upon sentient beings. But there they are, you will find they give you, they will teach you more in many, many different ways than your actual teacher does. Why? Because you run into them all over the place. So when we do, we've got to be humble. So that's the fourth one, develop humility. Without humility, we won't learn. So in summary, so we're enhancing the cherishing love. You know, like we don't want to lose it here by suddenly making ourselves be bigger, better than the other person. Way to do that is to subdue pride and cultivate respect for others. In the same way we respect our teachers who are showing us the path and directing us in what to do, we still need others, and we need to respect them for the great kindness that they have extended to us, and for the fact that by cherishing them, we can become enlightened. So this is related to the perfection of ethics and also to equalizing self with others. And so one of the things that said, you know, ask yourself what you're proud of. And then you'll find that whatever you are proud of is highly dependent upon other, whether it be a person or something that's not a person. And that's, you'll always find there's nothing that can actually support your arrogance other than wrong ways of thinking. Let's now work to the third verse. Geshe Langri Tangpa said, during all my activities, I will probe my mind. And as soon as an affliction arises, since it endangers myself and others, I will train myself to confront it directly and avert it. So what we're saying is, you know, as soon as... we are not very, well, I don't know, you guys might be, but I'm not, not so good at driving out afflictions. Sometimes you can recognize them, that they're there, and you sort of leave them, and then they take control over your mind. Other times you can notice them, but it's too late. They just take over the mind straight away. So we have to sort of learn about them, because they are our sort of enemies. They produce all the suffering that we experience. So we're not going to actually try and get rid of them unless we know how disadvantaged how disadvantaged we are by having afflictions.
It's, you know, like living with some really bad housemates, isn't it? and we might.
Yeah, or like it's very, you're at a huge disadvantage if you're trying to give up alcohol, but all your friends drink, and they come over with drinks. You know, so you can find, and if you give up any bad habit, you've got to sort of analyze and see, how is this hurting me? It's only when you see, the disadvantages of carrying on with that habit, will you be inspired to give it up. So we are habituated to afflictions. That's our karma. Karma, afflictions produce these ways of acting all the time, reactions. So if we want to stop that, we've actually got to see what's it doing? How is it harming me? How does it harm others? When we can see that quite clear and acknowledge, man, this, I can't keep living like this, then we can start to try and stop them. And the way we stop them is using two mental factors called mindfulness and vigilance. So mindfulness is just, recollection of what an affliction is. You remember, afflictions are like this. They feel like this. They arise when these sort of things happen. So when these sort of things are about to happen, I need to be vigilant. I need to keep my mind, either withdrawn from things that produce afflictions, or notice immediately when an affliction is about to arise. Related to the perfection of concentration, because you do need to keep an eye on your mind. You need to be sort of concentrated. And it's related to the faults of self-absorption. So our afflictions are always supported by the self-cherishing and the self-grasping. So whatever the affliction is, you can go, the major cause of it all is self-grasping ignorance. You go, okay, now I've got this other mental factor called anger. Well, how's anger and self-grasping related? What keeps them together? Self-cherishing. Self-cherishing is a condition that supports all these afflictions. Okay. Next verse. When I encounter beings of unpleasant character, and those oppressed by intense and negative karma and suffering, as I'm finding a treasure of precious jewels, I will train myself to cherish them, for they are so rarely found. So the beings of unpleasant character, of course, are those who have accumulated or have not accumulated merit in the past. So, of course, afflictions arise without any sort of trace of control. So you get ill-tempered people. So there's intense negative karma can arise. So intense negative karma means basically that you could kill your mother or your father. You could deliberately hurt your teacher. Yeah. So this is like intense negative karma. Yet when we find, and if you look at what do we do when we normally know of people like that? Well, we either criticize them, or we will talk about their bad behavior and often confuse the behavior with the person. And most times we will remove ourselves from their presence. We don't even want to be close to them, either physically or mentally.
Or delete them from Facebook.
Yeah, just get rid of them for us, isn't it? Yet here the advice is quite opposite to that. When you think about it, you don't run into people like this every day, do you? It's rare. So it's sort of saying, well, you know, finding a treasure of precious jewels is also very rare. But if you did, you'd hold on to them, wouldn't you? This is, well, it's the same here. It's very rare to find someone of unpleasant character oppressed by intense negativity.
Actually, Eddie, this reminds me, quite a few years ago when there was I was leading a course at Chenrezig Institute, I was asked to lead a course on overcoming disturbing emotions. And I've led a few up there before, and the director said, oh, Miffy, there's this really disturbed, really difficult person that's booked for the course. You know, I'm just kind of giving you a heads up, which was great. And so they really, really kept me on my toes. They challenged every single thing that I said. And so I was able, because I kind of was prepared, I was able to use them to really hone exactly what I needed to say, and use all of their examples and kind of embrace their, you know, their qualms and all of that. So I thought it went really well, and it really focused my mind. And then afterwards, some of the people came up and said, the thing that really struck them was that regardless of how many times I was interrupted or criticized or whatever, I never lost my cool, and I never even went red in the face. Mm. And so that really became the most memorable thing for everybody, that I was able to actually demonstrate how to be patient in the face of adversity.
So that's have a look at, so this verse can be summarized like this. So we're extending and deepening compassion by holding difficult people dearly. To do that, you actually have to know about the disadvantages of anger, meaning the faults, and how to apply antidotes to them. And the treasure trove means the benefits of cherishing is like empathy, compassion, patience.
And really, the only way that I was able to do it was to think, this is a difficult person, but I'm on their side, like I'm here for them. And yep. Then that made it, you know, possible to do it.
Yeah. See, so just in the same way that you thought like that and then acted on it, we need to do the same. So what will often happen to us is that we will go out into the world and forget a lot of the Dharma stuff that we know. And then when we meet up with a difficult person, we can't quickly call upon our refuge, you know, the Dharma that we know. And so we can also become angry and upset just like the other person. But if we can keep remembering when we go out into the world, every person I meet, whether they're difficult or whether they're friendly, they are teaching me something. What is it? You know, so I need to be patient to see what they're teaching me. I need to have a sense of empathy towards them. We are, you know, that sort of thing. So Thupten Jinpa in the book Mind Training says, since it is rare to find a precious gem, we do not discard it, but rather keep it and cherish it. In the same way, beings of unpleasant character are not so easy to find. Yet, in dependence upon them, compassion arises, and in dependence upon them, the awakening mind arises. Without making deliberate efforts, it is rare to encounter such objects, as these will allow us to develop the Mahayana paths. Why? Because compassion does not arise towards the noble ones and those who are excellent in the world. So they cannot help us enhance the awakening mind. Therefore, they can't lead us to Buddhahood. But this person could. So when we meet these people, this is what it requires. Some effort and some joy. Oh, a precious gem, rare to find. First person today. Yep. Right? Okay, now chill out.
It's so true too, Eddie, because, you know, out of all the courses that I led, that one with that difficult person stands out in my mind as the best one that I've ever led.
Yeah, well, we become careful. You know, and you actually want to help them, Yeah, you don't want to hurt them anymore. You know that they are already on the borderline there. But others out of jealousy treat me wrongly with abuse and slander. I shall train to take the defeat upon myself and offer the victory to others. So here, giving the victory to others means restraining ourselves when we want to dominate others physically or verbally. Seeking to control or have power over others does not bring happiness in the long term to ourselves or others. That was the fifth verse. So here, once again, we're extending and deepening love. Now, the love here is the wishing love. So challenge selfishness, cultivate the unbiased, courageous, and wishing love. It's related to the attitude, to the exchange of attitude. Now, we're actually, there is an exchange of attitude here, isn't there? We are making them, first up, really important. Not me, but them. So we exchange our attitude. The focus is on them. What is it that they need? So we give it to them, just like you said yourself before, you know, you, the practice of generosity, you place your attention on them. You know they wish to be happy. They don't wish to experience suffering. You do your best to bring that about. So you know, normally it's just yourself. Well, I really don't want to suffer. But because it's wonderful, because you put your attention on them and practice in this way, you know, you get your happiness anyway. Whereas if you just made it about you and thought this person is rude and so forth, you know, you don't, you're not happy and neither are they. When someone whom I've helped or in whom I've placed great hopes mistreats me in extremely hurtful ways, I'll train myself to regard him as my precious teacher. So voluntarily endure difficulties. Challenge your own impatience. And by doing so, cultivate what they call forbearance. Once again, it's related to the exchange of attitude and it's also related to the perfection of patience. In brief, I will train myself to offer benefit and joy to all my mothers, both directly and indirectly, and secretly take upon myself all the hurts and pains of my mothers. So here we come to the verse of, you know, this giving and taking on the breath. We have to change our attitude, challenge our fear, cultivate courage. And of course, like I said, this is related to Tonglen and related to the perfection of concentration.
So, Eddie, I'll just share something as well. Just today, one of our students was supposed to have a knee operation, but she fell over and had got a cut on her knee. So the doctors put it off because they didn't want to have any infection. So she wrote to me saying, oh, she's like really, you know, upset and disappointed that it was put off. But in our conversation, toing and froing, she's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe there's this perfect opportunity for Tonglen with the grinding pain in my knees and I almost missed it.
That's right. That's right. That's wonderful that she almost missed it but didn't miss it.
But didn't miss it. And so then...
Did not miss it.
I mean, yeah. And the way to kind of, when you are racked with pain like that, I mean... to really incentivize it, I find that if you think, well, what about all of our elderly gurus, our elderly lamas, you know, that suffer from arthritis and frozen shoulder and all sorts of pains like that. If I'm going to be racked with pain, at least let's start by taking the pain from our gurus and then, you know, all the rest of the sentient beings.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so here we can use our Mental problems, mental pains, and physical pains, like as other, what we call foundations, so you can place the pains of everyone else that you care for and your teachers and so forth on yours. You know, so yours will hold theirs. And then you do the giving and taking. The other thing I would suggest that anybody who experiences physical or mental pain quickly say yes or good. Because that suddenly gives the pain meaning and purpose for you. Whereas anyone who says no, they don't want what has happened to have happened, that adds another layer of suffering onto yourself.
Yeah, it's really counterintuitive, isn't it? But that if you go with it, then there's this enormous amount of energy that you can
That's
use.
That's right. Yeah, you go with it. You've got many, many reservoirs of strength to go with it. But when you don't, you just have that.
You lock all of that up, actually.
That's right.
Capacitate.
That's right. That's right. So verse 8, so all those previous 7 verses all had to do with the method of, the methods involved in generating the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. It's furthermore, through all these method practices, together with a mind undefiled by stains of conception of the 8 extremes, and that sees all phenomena as illusory, may I be released from the bondage of mistaken appearance and conception. So this is a verse that I've taken from another book because it's much more, it points much more deliberately at what the verse is about, whereas other verses are not so specific. So most people, he's got these 8 extremes. Well, the 8 extremes come out of 2 extremes. And the 2 extremes are the extreme of existence and the extreme of non-existence. So in the extreme of existence, we're taking things that do exist, that conventionally exist, but being extreme about them, thinking that these things that conventionally exist inherently exist. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is that we're taking things that do exist to be non-existent. And so there's these 2 extremes. And then out of them, you have nihilism. These other 8.
So is that the nihilism, the taking the things that actually do exist?
Actually do exist, don't exist. There's nihilism, and the other one would be, there's another term for it, isn't it?
Essentialism.
Essentialism, that's it. So seeing, this is last time, sees all phenomena as illusory. So seeing all phenomena as illusory means to see them to be, or to acknowledge them to be, as empty of inherent existence, not existing as they appear, and not findable when searched for in their basis of designation. So anything that exists has parts. All the parts come together, you see one thing. You give that one thing that you're looking at a name. If you look within the phenomena that you've named for that thing, it's not there. Right? So it's a real simple way of going about it. Just take anything that your eyes put on, your hands put on, you put in your mouth, and you'll know that thing has parts. What am I calling it? Oh, lolly. So I have a lolly in my mouth. Well, where is it? You know, it's this round thing. So what is it? Within the parts? No. Is it a single piece? Is it one single part of the lolly? Is the lolly a part of the lolly? You go, no. The part of the lolly belongs to the lolly. But the part itself is not the lolly. But what if I put all these parts together? Well, a whole lot of things that aren't put together will not be the thing. So we see that the object is empty of inherent existence, the existence it seems to have. So although they are empty, they do appear. And while they appear, they're also empty. So the current, this verse actually has to do about what they call maintaining purity. So the purity here means the objects are without the inherent existence they appear to have. They've always been pure right from the get-go. There has never been anything inherently existent. But the mind and our senses, present that appearance to us, so that they appear inherently existent. In fact, they're not. So we need to abandon our clinging and our attachment to those objects.
So Eddie, is this? Can I now ask Mandy's question?
Sure.
So she listened to last week's class and wanted to clarify what she thinks a stain is. So is the stain that you're mentioning something that obscures the Buddha nature and prevents our Buddha nature factors from being fully realized? Is that what a stain is?
That's one of the, so we have afflictive and cognitive stains, and they're obscuring the Buddha nature.
Right. And then with love, is love a pure feeling that you give unselfishly to another living being?
If we can develop the mind correctly, yes. That's the ideal love that they're talking about in Buddha, in the Buddha's teachings and the Dharma.
Okie dokie.
Okay.
And so with the stains, the cognitive stains and the afflictive stains, so they're both obscurations. They're things that hold us back.
That's
from
right. They obscure the mind. So sometimes when we talk about, we ask, what is the Buddha nature? So one way of describing it is that it is the ordinary mind obscured by cognitive and afflictive stains, which is empty of intrinsic existence. Because it is empty of intrinsic existence, the mind can be changed, and those obscurations are not within the nature of the mind. So obscurations arise dependently, therefore they are empty of any intrinsic existence. The mind also arises dependently, so it also is empty of intrinsic existence. Both the mind and the obscurations, because they depend upon causes and conditions, is changeable.
And thank goodness for that.
That's right, thank goodness for that. Yeah, if it weren't the case, we'd forget all about the Buddha's teachings. There's no escape. It's just the way it is.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so it's related to bodhicitta, of course, and especially related to the perfection of wisdom. Now, I've put up this new slide, right? So we have eight verses, and they're asking us to do things. They're asking us to behave in certain ways. And I've sort of tried to just put it together in a very short sentence like this. So in the first verse, it says, recollect often the kindness of others. Second, respect others as spiritual teachers. Third, remember the living beings don't have faults. You can't go around blaming yourself or anyone else for the difficulties experienced in life.
And if I want to blame someone, I've got to blame the affliction.
Yeah, if you're going to blame anything at all, blame the afflictions. Self-cherishing and self-grasping and going like, I've got to get rid of you. You guys are no friends of mine at all. You are at fault. You produce the faults.
Out damn spot.
That's it. Yep. How can I help? Accept harm and defeat joyfully. Like, why? Because you can say the harm and the defeats are against self-cherishing and self-grasping. They are being harmed, and when they are harmed, that's good. So, like I said, it's not harm put on yourself or that you are defeated. That's, you don't want to be joyful about that. It's those types of minds that arise. So, you know, when you are patient, you know, you are defeating self-cherishing. So that your anger doesn't arise, because self-cherishing there, when you're not getting what you want, that's a great support, self-cherishing, for anger. It's a beautiful condition for anger to arise. And once again, the difficulties, loss and harm are my friends. So whenever they take place, it's like, so what can I learn? What have I actually lost here? What is the difficulty?
And actually, Eddie, Alison had said just before too that with pain, for instance, the more you fight pain, the more pain wins.
That's right.
If we go difficulties, loss and harm, instead of fighting them, they're my friends.
Yeah. So, you know, be courageously compassionate. And lastly, appearances are not true. So the appearances I'm talking about here are the main appearances, the appearances to mind. So one of the most simplest things you can do, so you can remember that, you know, whatever appears is not true. Another very skillful thing you can do is when the appearances arise, ask yourself, is it true? Now, really be honest with your answer. Because you might say, yes, it's true. It's true what I'm thinking. It's true. So you can ask another question, which, can you be absolutely sure that it's true? Then you get a little bit of a chance to go, oh.
Eddie, I've been using this one with Donald Trump. So, you know, my own personal views of Donald Trump, whatever they are. And so I see him on the telly, and I have this hold really closely to you know, how he's the cause of all the problems. But then it's like the appearances are not true. And all I have to say to myself is actually, he is the result of all the problems. And everything changes. Yeah. Instead of he's the cause of everybody's distress, he is the result of a distressed society.
Now, when you can ask yourself, like, how's my mind reacting when I think it is true?
Yeah, so right there, one is I'm just filled with hatred and despair, and the other one is completely grounding and going, okay, so now we have to care for everybody, and we've really got to get going because everybody's in a really big mess.
Yeah. So but one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to have this up here was, we all have difficulties in our lives. And what I would like you to do is to think about them in a new way and use these eight sort of prompts that you can do to challenge, you know, if something is a difficulty or a challenge, then that's because you're looking at it in a way that you have, that it's called a difficulty or challenge to you.
So everybody get out your phones and take a photo of the new slide so it's there so you can whip it out whenever you need to.
Now, so, you know, like, look at your own life or stuff that's happened recently or that might happen in the future. If you call it a difficulty, then how are you going to work with it? Is it, you know, is it the person you're labeling difficult, or is it the situation?
Mandy says she's already taken a photo and it's going up on her wall.
So you know, you guys know, don't you, that, you know, every day the Dalai Lama recites the eight verses of thought transformation to himself. Every day he does that. We could do the same. Believe me, it'll take, what, less than 4 minutes to recite it once you've got it down. And when you find yourselves in situations where you know it's being labeled difficult or seems that way, then you know you can recollect some of these things. You might go, oh, the precious jewel, my little treasure, here they are. Now I've got to remember, the person has no faults, they are like a jewel. So what's going on here?
A very orange jewel.
Yeah, so we pay attention. How can I help? Anyway, in summary, you know, we've looked at, there's been three assessment questions in here. We've answered all of them. And lastly, I'll put up this thing about the application to life. So in brief, you know, self-grasping and self-centeredness are not the same. Although they both hinder progress on the bodhisattva path and are obstacles to Buddhahood. Now, self-grasping apprehends the self as inherently existent, and self-centeredness holds our own happiness as more important than others. Cherishing others means that all living beings are important and that their collective happiness matters more than my own. You know, so a lot of people are behaving in line with this idea. You know, they go out and demonstrate about the big differences to the climate change are bringing on. So it's not just about them. It's about the whole world that they're concerned with. So people do cherish others. And, you know, we can too. We have this thing in thought transformation called taking suffering as the path. What that means is, use all of your sufferings as a platform or as a support for the suffering of others in the Tonglen practice. And to take happiness as a path means to give away all your possessions and merit in the Tonglen practice. Don't cling to anything. And whereas at last, the thing about purity means to release clinging to things as if they did exist from their own side. And so I like to release the clinging to things as if they did exist from their own side. Basically, this means that all the qualities that you think exist from the side of the person or the object, they're actually not there. Don't cling to them as if they were.
So it's really reversing that just habit that we have.
Yeah. And the reversal is legitimate. It's also behaving like in accord with the reality because the qualities are not there. You know, so knowing that, then we shouldn't cling as if, to them as if they were. You know, it's that sensible. And then we just acknowledge that that's the illusion. You know, it looks like the good or the bad qualities are coming from the side of the object that I'm engaged with. Now remember here, the object could be a mental object. You might be thinking of something that happened 15 years ago and the person has died now, but you're still upset about what they did. So you've got a mental object, a picture of that person, and thinking that all those things that they're doing are like coming from that, right? And it's hurting you. That's just not true. So drop all that stuff. And we've just come up to the end of our class. So look, I'll just put this up here. Try and memorize that verses. They don't take a lot of time to do. You can do a couple a week. And then, if possible, try and, you know, come back to this presentation, look at these slides and go, what's that first one about? Oh, yeah, the major thing is doing is cherishing others. And what's the second? Oh, I've got to cherish them even more. I've got to enhance it. And what's that third one? Oh, yeah, that's about, I've got to really get a good control over my afflictions using mindfulness and vigilance. So you actually sort of, you know, in a few words, you can very quickly go through and say, eight verses thought transmission, yeah, they're about this. This is about that. You've got it in your mind. And so when things happen to you, you can very quickly just call upon that verse, recite it, and then bring everything that you recollect about it and act on it.
So Deborah said, this turns our way of thinking on its head. Thank you.
Well, I have to thank the Buddha, Deb, and you know all the wonderful lineages that have come after and passed this material on to us. It is a wonderful thing, that's for sure. And like if you pointed out before, yeah, there are many forms of thought transformation in the world that bring about happiness in this life. Now, thought transformation will bring about happiness in this life, but also future lives. So it's a very useful, incredibly useful.
So Eddie, also just so that everybody knows that there still is a next Wednesday night. Wednesday nights haven't finished. So for the next couple of Wednesday nights, we're doing Singanatha practice, which is the special practice given by His Holiness the Dalai Lama to help heal things like COVID and climate change. So I'll be leading the next two Wednesday nights, same time, same place. Because Alison said, thank you, it's always a bit hard when our classes end. So yes, it's the end of the course, but it's not the end of Wednesday nights.
No, we get a chance to, you know, use the mind of enlightenment, isn't it? Because we're doing that practice, like I say, not just for ourselves, it's for the world, it's for all living beings. So if you remember that, that's the most important thing. How you do the practice, how it goes, do the best you can. But we can all bring a good motivation to it. We can all decide, this is why I'm doing it. So, is there anything anybody else would like to say? Are there any final questions?
You haven't left much time there, Eddie.
What questions do you have for me?
There isn't anything else that has been
okay. Okay, well, I want to say thank you, then, for all being here, giving me a chance to learn about the mind of enlightenment and thought transformation and to share it with you. So thank you very much. Brings me closer to enlightenment. So I dedicate for your well-being, the well-being of all the people who come to our center, in fact, for all living beings. May they all have long, healthy lives. May they meet teachers of the Mahayana Buddha Dharma. May they engage in these paths with a sense of joy and bring about the accomplishment of the path. So dedicating just as the great Bodhisattva Samanta Bhadra and Manjushri did in the past, present and future, I dedicate these merits created by ourselves, the Buddhist Bodhisattvas and sentient beings who are like a dream or an illusion, yet existing in mere name. May we achieve enlightenment, which exists in name only, and liberate all dreamlike sentient beings. Okay, folks, thank you very much.